Choke points.
Let's go.
It is one of the most popular ways to get across I-5 in North Seattle, and it's about to go away. This is a project that not a lot of people know about.
And no, not a lot. And that's why I'm doing it, to make sure more people get it. I mean, the North 145th Street overpass of I-5, right there at the new light rail station, is about to close for 7 months. You will not be able to cross the freeway starting Monday. And talk about under the radar. I had no idea this was coming. It took a listener texting me on Tuesday asking me what was going on here that I found out about. And I'm glad that person reached out, because this is a huge deal. The city of Shoreline's Eric Bratton says 145th needs serious improvements to handle all the upcoming growth created by that new light rail station.
So we're going to be putting in left turn lanes. We're going to be widening the roads so we have sidewalks that is accessible for everybody to use. There's a lot that needs to be done to improve 145th.
And the city will be removing all of the signals on either end of the overpass and replacing them with two-lane roundabouts.
Roundabouts turned out to be the best way of making sure we had an efficient flow of traffic through the region. Otherwise, it would just get bogged down with lights. So we're going to be putting roundabouts at either end, which will help with that traffic flow much better. You're not going to have to cut across traffic.
Oh, you know how everybody loves roundabouts, David, especially two-lane roundabouts. That's going to be a huge learning curve for everybody there. But they should greatly reduce some of the crashes on either end, because if you've driven around that area, especially people heading westbound to try to get to southbound I-5, you know, they cut around, they turn after the signal because there's so little room to kind of queue up there. So the roundabouts will eventually help. But okay, this full 7 month closure, why are they doing that? Why not just kind of do it in stages? Well, Bratton says they're doing it because it'll get it done faster and save them money.
We recognize it's going to be a bit of a pain for people to move around, but it really is going to be better for the project and shorten the time frame.
So what are drivers supposed to do during this closure? 145th is a major access point for I-5 drivers, both on and off the freeway. Here's the good news. One lane in each direction of that overpass will technically stay open, but only for freeway access. So you'll be able to go and kind of sneak around and still take a left to get onto southbound. You'll still be able to get on and off there. It's just, but you won't be able to go any further west of that signal there. So you technically can't cross, but access will still be available.
The overpass will be reduced to one lane, but it's still accessible for access to I-5. Okay. You won't be able to go westbound on 145th, but you'll still be able to access I-5.
Now, if you're confused a little, I get it. I put a map up there at mynorthwest.com to kind of show exactly what the access looks like. The best way to cross the freeway during this closure will be go up to 155th or go, you know, get off earlier at 130th and then work your way over. And while this 7 month closure is going to be a huge pain, it isn't the end of the work. Bratton says the widening of 145th west of I-5 will continue through the fall of 2025. So if you have questions, you want to reach out to the people from the city of Shoreline. Again, this is a city of Shoreline project. There's a project email, construction hotline in my web article. And I also found out something, Dave, very interesting about the city of Shoreline and the city of Seattle and King County during this discussion with Eric Bratton yesterday. Because most of us think that, okay, Seattle ends and Shoreline begins right there at 145th. So who, you know, does it right down the middle of? Well, Shoreline doesn't own any of that 145th overpass. None. It's a WashDOT property because technically that's Highway 523. And so Seattle is south. WashDOT owns the middle, and then it's King County that actually owns above it. Shoreline just is on the west-hand side. But since WashDOT and King County were like, this isn't really on our priority list, the city of Shoreline said, okay, this is for our community, so we're going to do it ourselves. It's kind of interesting. I always thought that there was a little share there, but nope. Yeah, it's kind of interesting. Three little jurisdictions coming together with one little overpass.
How about that? Does I-5 have to be closed at any point in this project?
No, don't believe so. No, because, again, they're doing the work really primarily on either end and then working on the overpass a little bit. But, yeah, primarily it's just it shouldn't impact I-5, if at all. There could be some nighttime lane restrictions or things, but nothing super significant that I can see in the project page.
Coming up at 7:35, we have a special guest commentary from Cairo News Radio's Paul Holden on the magic and the optimism of opening day. Let's get an update on everything happening in the House of Representatives, shall we? From CBS congressional correspondent Scott McFarlane, I wanted to begin by asking him about Congress's response to the Baltimore bridge collapse and how much help is available in the budget?
They have some at their discretion already, Dave. The Biden administration says its infrastructure bill and its Inflation Reduction Act bills have helped them secure some money for emergency repairs. But overnight, there was this growing sense among congressional staffers and those who are speaking in Baltimore that this is just going to be an enormous price tag that, you know, ends with the word billions. And that's more than the Biden administration has at its disposal and at its discretion. So it's going to need Congress to move on this. Based on my speaking with congressional staff, Dave, it's really just each party talking to themselves. They're not talking to each other. And at this moment, appropriating anything in Congress is uniquely tricky because of the dysfunction, the gridlock, the narrow margins, and the election.
But if anything qualifies as an emergency, I mean, this is like a, you know, like a hurricane or some other disaster, isn't it?
Sure does. And I think, you know, if you're a member of Congress or you're somebody who represents a part of America far away from Baltimore, you can just, you know, imagine a year from now, 2 years from now, a storm hits, an emergency hits you. You don't want somebody out of state messing with your money or tying things up. But there still needs to be a legislative vehicle that moves to get money approved. And they've shown in this Congress they can't move baseline legislative vehicles. They narrowly averted a debt ceiling crisis, which would have impacted all of America. These government shutdown standoffs are not accidental. They're happening because of dysfunction. That could slow things down, Dave. And paralysis is the last thing we need when there's an expedient, emergent need for money in Baltimore.
On the IVF crisis, in vitro fertilization, where does that stand now?
There's a bill in the U.S. House and a matching bill in the U.S. Senate that are worth tracking now, because this Democratic-sponsored piece of legislation to provide federal protections for IVF for women, families nationwide, it's actually starting to pluck off Republican supporters. Four House Republicans have just signed on to a bill to provide federal protections for IVF. Cognizant of either the electoral impact of not being in support of IVF if you're in a competitive race this year, but it also gives a bit of momentum to this legislation, which could codify federal protections for IVF, as some states still maintain the discretion to have their court systems limited for some women in some places. This is worth monitoring as we get closer to the election, especially, Dave, as we get closer to congressional primaries in many states around America.
Yeah. Well, this is all because of the Alabama ruling, right? Is there any indication that other states are poised to follow Alabama's lead on this?
It's a good question. I think ultimately that court ruling kind of raised the same suspicions of the Supreme Court's overruling of Roe versus Wade, that if you empower states to do things that limit women's reproductive rights, some states may take to it. Some states may go for it, especially as, you know, Republicans try to outflank each other to win state legislatures. There's a grave concern of that, if not an immediate concern of that. And I think you see Congress moving in a bipartisan way on anything. It's worth noting, especially on a real volatile issue, a politically charged issue, like women's reproductive rights.
Yeah. In the Supreme Court arguments the other day on the issue of whether doctors who are opposed to abortion need further protections, even the conservative justices on the court seemed reluctant to push this issue any farther. It sounds like they think it's gone too far.
Yeah, the people who read the court well say all the justices, or at least many of them, expressed some reservations about taking the next step, including on the abortion pill mifepristone. I think there's ultimately going to be a set of rulings at the end of June, Dave, that are the most charged and the highest profile of this term, including on that issue, including on Trump's presidential immunity case, which goes to arguments on April 25th. June's going to be a highly charged month of Supreme Court rulings, no matter how they rule. And boy, it sure does happen at a sensitive time, 4 weeks before the Republican National Convention, 16 weeks before the election.
CBS congressional correspondent Scott McFarland. Moving on now to the legal cases involving Donald Trump, specifically the Stormy Daniels hush money case, which has been given a trial date of April 15th. I asked him, should we expect any surprises there?
We could have some high-octane witnesses, potentially, including Michael Cohen, Trump's former fixer, who has been an outspoken critic of Trump's. Just, you know, baseline reminders about these cases. Just like in federal courts, the New York City court does not allow cameras or live feeds, so you won't see or hear this trial. And I always believe that takes some of the edge off of the shocking, surprising twist moments because America can't see them. but you're certainly going to have some dirty laundry put out there. This is about hush money payments to a porn star. It doesn't lack for sizzle or lack for sensationalism, even though I think legal analysts have said this is the least tenuous, least precarious of the four legal situations in criminal cases against the former president.
Well, what's, I mean, we know, I think we know most of the facts in this case. It seems pretty open and shut. I mean, you got the guy who was in charge of the checks and of covering up the story, Michael Cohen, testifying. Does Trump pull a rabbit out of the hat here? What do you think?
Well, we may see another version of that presidential immunity argument that doesn't seem to fit real well in the other cases either. He's going to try to impeach some of these witnesses. You know, oftentimes people who turn against you and turn in favor of the prosecution aren't angels. They aren't saints, and they can, you know, you can try to impeach them as a defense lawyer, but also make the argument that this is, you know, just business. But I think what prosecutors are going to argue, Dave, is that this is more than just the, quote, hush money case, that this was an attempt to influence an election by hiding things from the American voters. And I think you're going to see the arguments go down that path. How Trump chooses to defend himself against that broader issue, that remains to be seen.
How far does that argument go? I mean, there are probably a lot of politicians who clearly don't want parts of their past to come out. Is it illegal if you're running for office to hide your dirty laundry somehow?
This is a referendum on that argument, isn't it, Dave? I mean, this is a referendum on just that point. And I think you're going to hear both sides lean into the impact or non-impact on the election. But that's really one of the politically curious parts of all this, Dave, is that this doesn't seem to have dinged the former president's political standing.
No.
And, you know, hush money payments to porn stars is something the Americans may just tune out. Election interference, well, that's a more broader, transcendent issue. We'll see if that resonates, if he's convicted of trying to fool American voters.
CBS's Scott McFarland. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Dave.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. A woman in Arkansas helped her community weather some of life's toughest storms, literally, and is now being honored for it. On March 31st of last year, it was a day many will never forget in the town of Wynn, Arkansas, as a deadly and destructive tornado ripped through the area.
I felt the wind picking up and I just floored it.
She's not a paramedic or a doctor, but Mavis Smith wanted to offer a lifeline to help those who needed hope during the recovery efforts. She told local TV station K8 News.
And there was a guy there that had been thrown out of his camper.
He was thrown out of his camper and needed medical attention, so she loaded him up, took back roads because of debris scattered everywhere, and headed to the hospital. In fact, she did that several times that day as ambulances were finding it tough to get around. But Mavis wanted to do more, so she used her auctioning business to ask for help to assist people in Wynn with donations and supplies, food, right down to providing Easter eggs and candy for children since the tornado had stolen even that.
I'm here every Saturday afternoon at 6 o'clock.
And it's not just tornado victims, but anyone in need that gets Smith's attention. Community members say,
I mean, she took up donations after donations after donations of different things. And it just amazed me. It just touched my heart.
So this week, Mavis's neighbors decided to honor her efforts. She was given a surprise ceremony attended by half the town and handed a check worth a few $100s.
Right now, though, let's talk Mariners. For me, the start of a new baseball season isn't just about rooting for the team. It's about learning the new names of players I've never heard of because C-SPAN has very bad sports coverage. And I rely on Mike Salk from 710 Seattle Sports for help with that.
The core stayed the same. You don't need to relearn Julio's name, I would hope.
Right, no.
The starting rotation's going to look pretty much as it did for most of last year. Luis Castillo is going to make his second straight opening day start as one of the 10 or 15 best pitchers in baseball. And this Mariner rotation looks the same with George Kirby and with Logan Gilbert and Bryce Miller after that. I mean, that is really the centerpiece of what this team is all about, is their starting rotation. And then the other side, Julio and Cal Raleigh, J.P. Crawford. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of those names should be very familiar to Mariners fans over the course of the last few years. But as always, there's, I don't know, 40-50% new names from opening day a year ago.
I just remember from last season, there was a lot of momentum and suddenly they seemed to hit a wall. So do they have what it takes to get over the hump this year?
Well, I think last year was a little different from that. So they started off really badly last year. It was a really rough, it was a mediocre April. It was a horrendous May, a bad June. And then they came alive in July and were the best team in baseball through July and August. And unfortunately kind of ran out of gas right at the very end in September. I think there's, you know, a lot of frustration with the way last season ended. And it's led, I think, to a narrative where people think, oh, the Mariners were terrible last year. Well, they weren't. They won 88 games. They had a pretty good season. They missed the playoffs by a game. But obviously, that was well short of where the expectations were for them coming off a playoff season the year before. Are they better than that this year? Sure. I mean, like, they could be.
You don't sound very confident.
Well, it's baseball. What is there to be confident in, right? I mean, like, are they one of the 10 best teams in baseball? Yeah, I think they are.
That's good.
Do they play in the best division in baseball? Yeah, they probably do. And getting past both Texas and Houston is going to be a challenge because this is a very good division. But are they a good team? Yeah, I mean, they're built the way really good teams are built, with excellent starting pitching, what should be a solid bullpen, and an absolute superstar in Julio Rodriguez.
And I feel like we go into these seasons oftentimes with sort of a mantra, and for the last couple seasons, it had been this good vibes only type of thing that Gino Suarez, our third baseman, had brought in a lot. We traded him away now. We brought in some other guys. It feels like that energy has shifted a bit from the kind of relaxed good vibes feel to, is it more from what you saw down in training camp, is this a more disciplined team?
I don't know if disciplined is the right word, but maybe let's say a team that's sort of a little more workmanlike.
Okay.
Yeah, they sort of go into work, they're doing a job, and that's not to say they're not going to have fun, that there won't be, I mean, Julio still got the biggest smile in baseball, maybe the biggest smile in Seattle. Yeah. So, I mean, that's not going away anytime soon. He's still the personality of this team. But yeah, I think you may see, you know, last year there was a lot of expectation on them and they may have wilted under the pressure of some of that expectation, especially early. And it wasn't until everybody wrote them off that they finally started playing great baseball. I don't know that that expectation is there for them this year. And I think that may lead to a little bit more of an ability to just go out, play ball, workmanlike attitude, and hopefully that serves them well.
Any new rules this year, you know, triangular bases or some... Other changes that
they've gone through all the new rules the last couple of years. What do you make of it? Have you watched games with the pitch clock? What did you think? Did it bother you?
No, it didn't bother me at all.
Same.
It sped it up. So
I thought it was going to be terrible. Really? I really did. I really was upset about the pitch clock. I thought it was going to really not ruin the game, but you know, like part of what makes baseball great is the drama and the tension and the way it builds, especially once you get into September and October and the games get more important. And it didn't affect that at all. It still built. It was still tense. Well, still great.
There are fewer cutaways of pitchers spitting seeds on the mound.
True.
It's I noticed
true.
That.
That's important.
But that's good. I thought that was quite an improvement. So it sounds like you're, mildly optimistic this year?
I mean, I'm always optimistic. I learned my lesson. Last year, I thought they were going to the World Series. I was dead wrong. I got killed for it. So I'm a little scarred. I wrote about it this morning. If you have a few minutes at mynorthwest.com or seattlesports.com, it's easy to feel the scars of the last couple of seasons, specifically last year, and the way the season ended and the players being upset and Jerry DePoto's comments and the lack of extra money spent this offseason. It's easy to go into this season upset. That being said, it's opening day. It's spring. It's hope. It's renewal. It's everything that is great in the world happens when baseball begins once again. And as I wrote, and I hope you have a few minutes to read it, the 2024 team should not be held to whatever sins were committed before they got here. This is a new team, and they're a pretty good team. And it's a fun opportunity to see what they're capable of doing.
Mike Sox, 710 Seattle Sports. Let's talk supermarket sticker shock. Prices for eggs, milk, meat, chicken, cereal, produce, all dramatically higher, running well ahead of overall inflation. So why is that? Let's go to consumer man Herb Weisbaum, a contributing editor at checkbook.org. Why is this happening, Herb?
Well, because people can say supermarket sticker shock.
That's right.
And I wrote that.
I have to have a drum roll ready for you whenever you're on air, Herb.
That's that. Well, thank you, Colleen. Well, basically, there are some serious reasons. Overall inflation, but the problem is that the food at the supermarket is running much higher than the overall inflation rate. The overall inflation rate was 19% in the last 4 years. Grocery prices jumped 25%, way ahead of the rate. So there were the labor shortages during the pandemic. There were supply disruptions. We've had drought all across the globe. Avian flu, they killed 58 million birds in this country last year. So that drove up poultry prices and egg prices. And then, of course, the war in Ukraine, which affected wheat crop and also limited the global supply of fertilizer. One other factor is consumer demand for more expensive groceries. Turns out that during the pandemic, a lot of people started cooking at home and eating home more often, so they wanted more better products to have at home, higher quality products, and so that led to higher prices as well. But some suggest that corporate greed is to blame. And according to a report from the Groundwork Collaborative, that's a progressive think tank, they say, and this is a quote, outsized corporate profits are driving more than half of inflation. So that's the look at what's going on, a little bit of what's going on and maybe a little bit of profit taking.
What do you do? I mean, the whole idea of supply and demand is that if you boycott the stuff that's too expensive, prices have to drop. Or at least you can find a place that is actually sells it for less. You can bring prices down just by changing where you shop.
Well, that could happen in some cases. I don't think that's going to be a big deal at this thing because we're not organized in doing that. The government says that grocery prices are on their way down. They went up 11.8% in 2022. They cooled to 1% last year. They're predicting 0.4% this year. So things are moving in the right direction. But remember, that's a slowdown in price increases. It's not the prices are returning back to their pre-pandemic levels. So hopefully things are going to stabilize. But yes, there are a bunch of things you can do. You can make sure you use coupons and belong to the loyalty program to get the better prices you can get. You can make sure, and what I do is that you're being charged the right price for items when you check out. I have been overcharged for at least one item the last 8 times I've gone shopping. These
really?
Are usually things on discount. Yes. Huh. If the computer did not give me the discount that I was entitled to, and did I raise bloody heck with the manager of the store.
If you find it when you go back home, can you take the receipt there and say, hey, will they refund you?
Sure. Okay. And I take like the digital coupon. Like, here's the coupon that was in my app and it didn't give me the price. And I know sometimes this is an overring. Last time it was 67 cents. One time it was $2.50. One time it was $3.
Good job, Kurt.
So, you know, so do that. And then also keep in mind, thank you, that some stores are overall day to day and day at day out cheaper than other stores. And we looked at all the supermarkets in the Puget Sound area. We actually had people shop them. They actually shopped for a grocery list of a whole bunch of items, and they found after this 154 item list that if you shop at a grocery outlet, Walmart, and Winco Foods, you're going to be paying a whole lot lower prices. The warehouse clubs were also cheaper, and Trader Joe's did very well as well. And we have a special offer for you guys, which is that these ratings, which are only for subscribers, are available to your listeners until May the 1st. If you go to checkbook.org/CairoFM/food, you can get our ratings for all of these supermarket chains in the Seattle area, the Puget Sound area. We looked at both price, which we shopped, and quality, which we asked the shoppers in this area to give to us. So again, that's checkbook.org/CairoFM/food if you want to get all of our ratings for this.
I find people are still shy about joining those grocery store loyalty programs. They're like, I don't want to pass over my data, as they hold on to their iPhone and carry it everywhere with them. But, you know, I find that the benefit to those is that they will actually send you physical coupons for foods that you buy frequently. And so you're not just shopping for discounts and, oh, you like, you know, you don't like Cheez-Its, but you're going to buy them because they're on sale. They'll send you coupons for foods you buy weekly. And that's a huge savings.
Yeah, it's a good point. In the old days when these clubs first started, the supermarkets weren't organized enough to do anything with the data. And I remember what one of the cashiers said, don't even put your real phone number down. Just put a name and a different phone number or whatever. Now, if you're using the apps, of course, it's linked to your mobile phone. And so therefore, they're going to push stuff to you. You're going to get a lot more advertising messages from them. And they are getting more organized and they are using this data to different market you different things. We live in a world world where you have a choice in many cases. You either get marketed to and share your data, or you don't get the benefit of the sales. In this case, I'm not so worried about it, and I am working on a story about what supermarkets are doing with all this data now that they've become organized, and I will, of course, share that with you when we come to the end of the line. But, yeah, they're going to take your data and try to sell you stuff. There's no question about that.
Which is fine if it's food you normally buy. And take a calculator with you, too. There's a couple times that we've saved people some money. Just my husband and I are pretty serious about discount shopping. And, you know, a lady was searching for organic ground turkey or something. And there was a 3-pack and there was an individual. And it was cheaper to buy the 3 than buying 2. She didn't need 3. She needed 2. And we did the math for her. And she was like, oh, great tip. So you really have to go in there with a mindset of, you know, you're taking on the grocery store.
Yes, and you're also taking on the manufacturers. One of the key items in this article that I just did for Checkbook talks about skimpflation, where they make the packages a little tiny bit smaller, but they keep the price the same, which is a price increase. They also are doing shrinkflation, skimpflation, where they lower the ingredients in the packages, but shrinkflation is where the package itself is smaller. You know, the dimple in the peanut butter at the bottom, so it looks like it's the full jar, but it doesn't have as much inside. The only way you can beat that is to use unit pricing. Unit pricing is your friend. Colleen, I'm sure you know this. Unit pricing is a great equalizer. You want to see how much you're getting per measure, per ounce, per pound, per whatever, how many sheets of toilet paper per roll versus the other one. That is the only way you can battle this shrinkflation that is going on in all sorts of products. By the way, Dave, I know you're old enough to remember Mr. Whipple and Charmin.
Yes.
Colleen,
please don't squeeze the Charmin.
I know the Bears,
right. Okay, back in the 60s. So when this came out in the 60s, and Mr. Whipple, when this he started advertising this, they had 660 sheets per roll. Single ply, but 650 sheets per roll. You know how many there's on the super mega roll today?
What? 280.
336 that just dropped. It just dropped from 366. Now they're double ply, but I mean, that gives you some idea of how few you're getting now with the super mega roll. The only way to compare is to look at other toilet paper and find out how much the unit price is, how much you're paying per sheet.
And they're skinnier.
You can't tell by looking at,
but fatter, and they don't fit on toilet paper holders anymore. Have you noticed that? Even the ones from, because they're thinner.
Yeah.
So the rolls themselves, they've cut like a half inch off the sides of each, but they're trying to make it look like you have more, so they're fatter, but they don't fit on your toilet paper roll holder.
That's ridiculous.
I know.
You have to like pre-use it a little bit before you stick it in.
Now you do have to squeeze the Charmin. <That's>
We should get together, Herb, and just complain about shrinkflation. I got a lot to say.
I will go shopping with you anytime. You know, I had dinner last week with Mr. Ross.
Yes,
I had first time I saw him in 35 years, and he actually paid for his portion of the meal.
Hey! lucky.
I didn't have a choice, Herb.
That's true. Your wife made you do it. Okay.
You put my credit card on the tray there. So, anyway, good to see you, by the way.
Thank you. Yes, Colleen, I actually squozed his wallet, and I squozed not the Charmin, but his wallet, and the card popped out. It was really fun.
That's right. So, you're lucky only one popped out. It is Herb Weisbaum, the consumer man at consumerchequebook.org. Thanks, Herb.
Yes. Thank you, guys.
Buying a home is so out of reach for most young Americans. The bank of mom and dad is their only hope. Here's Mickey Gomez.
Seattle homes averaged just under $1 million. According to Redfin, the price has gone up 12% since last year. The Seattle real estate company says more than one-third of young adults expect money from parents to help with down payments. Cairo News Radio producer and resident millennial Paul Holden says this rings true for him.
You know, honestly, I would say it's been my experience with just about all of the major purchases in my life. My parents got my car. My parents paid for college. I had rules. And then now going into the home buying process, my parents not only want to be involved in helping me, but have helped my brother buy a couple of properties as well as he's been trying to figure out his stuff.
I had to ask, how does it feel to be a Nepo home buyer, a person who relies on family for monetary help?
I don't have any problems acknowledging the support that my parents have given me. And I think it's important for me to acknowledge that. But on the flip side, I still work hard and I still put my nose to the grindstone and get things done. The bigger problem is the fact that I can't afford a home while working three jobs.
Holden is engaged to his longtime partner and plans to marry soon. Even though his credit is good, his family doesn't want him to take out loans to pay for a wedding.
Both families are contributing. We're paying for very little. You know, we're paying for a couple of things here and there, but the wedding is going to be possible for that. And then my parents have said what's left over goes towards a down payment on a house.
And when it comes to critics who say he's privileged,
I understand that. I can't shy away from the help that my parents have, but I'm not going to shy away from a resource that helps me. I'm going to ask my parents for help. I know that you might feel that takes away something from me. I totally understand that.
And for people who don't have his options,
you know, Washington first buyer, first time home buyers, you know, there's a lot of assistance for first time for a lot of stuff. I would just kind of say, you know, are you using your resources? Because I'm lucky enough that my resource is my parents. And
when it comes to borrowing money,
truth be told, I'd rather take a loan out from my parents and pay my parents back than I would take a loan out from any bank.
Like so many other millennials, Holden says work doesn't pay enough.
I don't want to have children unless I can provide the same life that my parents provided for me. I don't think I can do that. Not in my line of work, not in my with my fiance's line of work. If we were an engineer and a nurse and did all the stuff my parents did, different story.
He plans to pay it forward too.
It is a tenet to me that, like I just mentioned, if I have kids, they need to enjoy the quality of life that I enjoyed, or at least close to it.
According to Redfin, young Americans who can't ask parents for money say they'll save, work a second job, and or live with parents or other family until they can make a down payment. Mickey Gomez, Cairo News Radio.
So Mickey's here. Gen Z expert David Burbank is here. David, you getting help from your parents?
No, not at all. I've actually...
Have you asked?
No. Oh. That was pretty clear. Family, youngest, though, right? Yeah, youngest of seven, you don't ask my parents for anything, really. But my in-laws, I will say, my in-laws, who I might be listening to this show, have been incredibly supportive to my wife and I, both emotionally, financially. We lived with them for a while. They helped pay for a bunch of stuff for our wedding. So I do have kind of surrogate Nepo home buyer things, but home buying is not on our on our radar currently. Just trying to make it happen, and you know.
Dave, did your generation not get help from their parents?
I think we borrowed $5,000 for our first house,
which today would be the equivalent of tens of thousands, right?
From my wife's grandmother.
So this isn't like a new young generation thing. We've all leaned on our parents for help.
Yeah, and you should. It's better than the bank. So what's your policy going to be, Mickey?
Well, as I was talking to my wife about the story last night, she goes, well, is this a bad thing? I mean, are you painting this picture as a bad thing? And I go, no. She goes, because I just want you to know that our kids are Nepo kids. Like, mm-hmm. we give our children everything. They also have to work hard for it, too. Just like Paul said, there's an expectation. He had to make good grades. So for our kids, too, like Gigi wants a new pair of tennis shoes. They're $175.
Woo.
It's for basketball. I said, well, here's what you got to do. So she's working on it. We're checking off the checklist. Once everything's checked off, I will be honest with you, we're not giving our kids money to buy a house, but we are willing them our houses because we're in the process of trying to buy another house. One will go to Javi, one will go to Gigi. They can do whatever they want with it. So some people will say, well, that's being a Nepo baby. That's being a Nepo home buyer.
Providing for your kids as you promised to do when you gave birth to them.
Right. I call it leaving a legacy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and both Paul and I are working more than one job and we still can't afford to, you know, save up for a house. So it's just the way that things are, especially in this city.
And and my kids are younger than you, David. And so I am worried about what happens when they are 25, 30 years old. You know, what is the cost of house of living going to be then? I mean, I never imagined that an easy home, a small little three bedroom home here in Seattle would cost $1 million.
That's gross.
What's it going to cost 15, 20 years from now when my kids are ready to buy? So
long live nepotism.